This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Oh boy, Rebecca, it is news wall to wall here at the Book Riot Podcast this week. 2020, which is saving all of its centrally book, you know, news that's not like COVID related for the end of the year. Interestingly, only one of these is a story related to COVID, and it's saying it's not a thing.
Yeah,
so, which is also interesting.
It's been a couple weeks since we did news here on Ye Olde Podcast, so some of these links have been piling up as we were in the, you know, in the zone of custom recommendations for folks. But yeah, it's interesting how few of these are tied to the defining parts of 2020, really, in terms of the rest of the news cycle.
Yeah, it's like cleaning up. Like, there's a Woodward thing we'll get to about Trump, the book supply and chain. People worried about with COVID and demand seems to be doing okay. Mm-hmm. And then everything else is, I don't know, kind of like book world a little bit. So let's do a sponsor and get into it here in just a second.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
I got a lot of recommendation related follow-up, and we're going to do zero of it today because we've got so much news. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. The most important feedback we got this week was about a new food product over in Mary Old, the Waitrose. I'm not sure he's pronounced, they probably say Waitrose. Supermarket grocery store chain has an alternative tortilla shaped product for the holiday season.
Okay.
It is a Christmas tree shaped tortilla. Big fan. All shapes are welcome here. There's a big tent under the tortilla shape revival. But not only is it Christmas tree shaped, it is flavored like turkey stuffing. So I don't know what to do with my body about this.
Is it a tortilla or a tortilla chip?
It's a tortilla chip.
Okay.
In the shape of a Christmas tree. that tastes like turkey stuffing, apparently.
That's not that far off from the usual triangular shape of a tortilla chip.
This is all tortilla-shaped deniers. I don't know what you're talking about. This is a serrated crescendo. That's way different.
Oh, my God. A serrated crescendo.
Show title, if that's ever a show title.
I am disturbed by how available those words were to you.
Look, I think about things. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what day it is, but that was ready.
But by God, we've got a serrated crescendo.
So I'll put a link in the show notes to an Instagram post. I like how now all the tortilla chip content is coming to me.
Is the listener who sent this in going to try the turkey stuffing flavored chip?
I don't have the email in front of me, so I'm so sorry. But I think it was only a screen cap of something they saw on Instagram and immediately had to forward. Listen.
Rebecca, your brand is strong.
Rebecca might be your internet mom, but I'm your tortilla chip uncle. In the back of the days of vanity tumblers, I definitely would have had a weird tortilla chip tumbler. That definitely would have happened. There's no question about it.
Yeah, it is like very much in the adjacent possible to your donut pun tumbler.
Yes, as I lay frying my beloved donut pun tumbler. Literary quotation donut pun tumbler, actually. Nothing more meaty than that.
I was about to say, you know, like someday in the past before I became the internet's mom and you became their tortilla chip uncle, I was about to be like, well, you know, we used to be cool, but I actually don't think that's ever been true.
We used to at least be differently grotesque versions of ourselves, maybe.
2020 has been a long one, Jeff.
Look, you're not different. You're just more.
Yeah, right? more distilled.
Yeah, it's a reduction. Mm-hmm. Through an alembic, we've created a Jeff and Rebecca sauce to pour over 2020. Here we go. Speaking of the sauces to pour over 2020, I don't know if it's so much a sauce as spice about Simon & Schuster being acquired, agrees to be acquired by PRH. What this really is Viacom agreeing to sell one of its meaningless subsidiaries to Bertelsmann to join with one of its Bertelsmann, which is the parent company of PRH, a significantly larger amount of its business comes from Penguin Random House, both because Bertelsmann is smaller and because Penguin Random House is bigger. But Viacom, just for context, they own things you might have heard of it, CBS, movie studios. And I can understand why Viacom is like, you know, we've got this legacy media business that doesn't grow great. I mean, books are in fine shape, but it doesn't help your quarterly earnings going up and to the right, which is what these publicly traded companies want to do. We can get some cash for it, and there we go. I'm not sure. I don't remember when we talked about this last, but we talked about our, you know, what we think would happen, what might happen, what we'd want to happen. If it were my druthers, I would like Simon & Schuster not to be owned by somebody else. That would be my preference. Because from a reader, I don't see a lot of upside to this. I actually don't actually see a lot of downside. I think the downsides are more industry-facing, less competition. PRH has more clout. That's where a lot of the opposition falls. I think my litmus test, we've talked about this a long time ago, my litmus test as a reader is, are there more books I want to read than I will be able to read? And the answer to that remains yes. So that part of it doesn't really matter to that, you know, uppercase Jeff right there. But to me, as someone who does this, as someone whose business is in the book world, I'm not sure what to think about it that much, Rebecca. And I think, was that the tenor of our head scratching? Yeah. Or tell me differently how you're feeling.
I agree with all of that. I think and it's interesting, you know, like the piece that we're going to link to here is the announcement in the New York Times, and it's from November 25th. And we're recording this on December 10th. So it's been a few weeks since this news broke, and there has not been much follow-up about it at all, which in itself is interesting. Mm-hmm. We have a follow-up piece from PW from November 30th with objections from the Authors Guild and a few other groups. The American Booksellers Association decries the move as well. But since then, there's been sort of no big news about it. And I think that's meaningful, or at least potentially meaningful. My metric is kind of the same. Like, I have not noticed a difference in reading life quality or the availability of way more interesting and good books than I will ever get to in my life since Penguin and Random House merged several years ago. Like, basically nothing feels different to me as a reader on the day after PRH was a thing than the day before, or now years later. And I'm kind of anticipating that that's how it's going to feel with Simon and Schuster as well. Certainly folks in the industry will be affected. Probably people who work at Simon and Schuster, or maybe also at the existing PRH, will be affected if they do any sort of like merging or reduction of overlapping imprints or anything like that. But we don't know what that's going to look like. Our colleague Kelly Jensen has noted that, you know, this might compress the mid list even further, and that means fewer opportunities for writers, and then, you know, subsequently all the people connected to writers, fewer opportunities for agents or fewer deals that editors can make. Like, it does impact employment inside the industry, but in our lives as readers, I think it might make a philosophical difference. Like, if you're just bothered that there are potentially fewer books, period, because publishers merge, then you're just going to be bothered. But in terms of actually feeling the impact, like in some sort of meaningful decrease in the availability of good books to read, I have not felt that. And I don't think that either.
And I think maybe I said this to you personally, or maybe I said it on the show, but I'll repeat it here. Remember how different it was when Random House didn't own Penguin? Oh wait, no, you don't. No, I mean,
it doesn't feel different.
For the people at Penguin and the people at Random House, I'm sure it feels a lot different. Maybe on the author agent supply side, right? Rather than the buy side, you know, the reading industry, the readers, dummies like us are on the buy side, but on the sell side, I'm sure it's different in a lot of different ways. But it does feel a little bit about arguing about the arrangement of a deck chairs on a ship that looks like the Titanic when the iceberg is Amazon.
Right.
To worry about whether or not Simon & Schuster is owned by HarperCollins or PRH, because the 900-pound gorilla is not affected. If anything, the 900-pound gorilla is maybe has a raised eyebrow at PRH even a little bit more today. Is that better for reading in books and the industry in the buy side? Or excuse me, the sell side? I don't know. I think that's the other piece of the scales here. Yes, there's consolidation. A, what does that actually mean? And B, does that consolidation have attendant compensations in other parts of the industry? I don't know. PRH, to this point, as we've said many, many times, does not seem interested, at least in ways we understand, in flexing its muscle with Amazon. It also could be that the 900-pound gorilla is great if you are also in the business of like stealing people's bananas, right? If they're on the same side selling books, we don't hear a lot of squawking from the PRH side about Amazon. It may not be that they don't want to squawk. It could be. Turns out in a pandemic, it was super nice to have. It's made much easier to get the right book to the right place at the right time from Amazon than in other situations. There are things that are very bad about Amazon. I would like many things they do to change. But I'm just not sure that the world is that much worse for a big retailer than it was. I just don't know. I haven't seen a compelling argument. There's a lot of hand-wringing. And there's certainly anti-patterns and ways this could go wrong. But there's basically two companies I can buy an operating system from for my computer. I'm all right. You know, that's one of, I'm not sure. It's hard to know. It's hard to know.
I think it's just one of those really tough situations where two things that are in tension with each other are true at the same time. And one of those things is that folks inside publishing can see the same problems with Amazon that, you know, other consumers see, and folks inside publishing care about independent bookstores as well and want to support that and have personal moral, ethical objections to Amazon. And they, it's an and, not a but.
Right.
Like, and they see the utility that Amazon has to the industry. And even though those things are both true and they both hold weight, at some point, somebody who makes decisions there has to make a decision about them.
Yes.
And so far,
do something about it.
Yeah. And so far, the decision that they seem to be making implies that what they get from working with Amazon outweighs what they would get from going against Amazon. And I don't know if that's true, but I believe that that is where they've landed on their assumption about it, and that there is data behind that in some capacity. I don't like it, but I think if we were going to see PRH make a move against Amazon or like really try to have their own robust online retail to compete with it. Mm-hmm. We would have seen that at some point. We have not seen that in the last several years since the merger. Like if you go to buy a book at PRH.com, it will give you somewhere between 5 and 10 retail options to mm-hmm. choose from to be directed away from PRH.com. You can make purchases there, but they're not trying to get you to. It's like you could buy this here or you could click to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, Books A Million, whatever, bookshop.org, mm-hmm. whatever. They're all listed there. And part of me wishes, you know, well, now that they have Simon & Schuster, they're going to be big, even bigger, and they'll have more power and they could really make a move against Amazon. But I just don't think it's likely. Like the bigger it gets, the less likely they are, actually, I think, to go yeah. against Amazon, because the more they rely on them. Like now we yeah. have to sell 50% of the books in the industry and make mm-hmm. sure that they get to places. And who is going to help us do that? It's a real like golden handcuff situation.
Yeah, it's like golden handcuffs and you have a slightly nicer jail cell. Right. And I don't, it's hard to know what the situation would be because it feels like, you know, we've seen in other industries when a couple of parties have leverage and they're trying to figure out who has more leverage. We saw it recently with Epic Games and Fortnite and Apple and the 30% cut. I'm not sure if anyone's followed that over there. But a couple of them swung the sticks they carry on their shoulder. Like they sit, most of those sticks just sit around. Right. Mm-hmm. And every now and again, you get to see them swing. At this point, does PRH have a big enough stick on its shoulder where Amazon says jump and PRH can say, you know what? I'm going to stay seated. I don't know. This is one thing we don't know. I don't think we're at the point where PRH can tell Amazon to jump. Amazon's like Amazon going Amazon. But if the goal is where PRH can at least countermand some of the stuff that makes, you know, a charitably Amazon reaping the rewards of their success and their business prowess and size, uncharitably be their cutthroat, vaguely, maybe actually monopolistic and antitrust kind of procedures. Putting the legal thing aside, at some point, competitors, cohorts, people in the same space compete outside of the law, right? They're not actually concerned about what the antitrust is like. What can we actually do and what can we actually get? The golden handcuffs for PRH might also be the distributed retail they have in the form of bookstores and Barnes and Nobles and bookshops and other places. Like, yeah, is Amazon the golden handcuffs for launching their own store? Is it everyone else? Who would be more mad if PRH launched their own store tomorrow? Mm. Indie bookstores or Amazon?
Well, I think it's also a situation where it's just true that PRH and now PRH Simon Schuster, whatever they're going to be called, needs Amazon a lot more than Amazon needs PRH. And
yeah, maybe. As a bookstore, if all PRH Simon & Schuster titles disappeared tomorrow from Amazon, is it a credible bookstore?
I wonder. No, but I think it doesn't matter to Amazon that much at this point. Like I think as a segment of their sales, mm-hmm. books have been increasingly de-emphasized. Yeah. And that's evident in the fact that books are not like a primary loss leader mm-hmm. at Amazon anymore, as we've seen by tracking weird discrepancies in pricing.
Weird pricing patterns, yeah.
Yeah, that I'm sure Amazon doesn't want to lose, you know, all of their book sales, but on the balance sheet, if they did never sell a book again, Amazon mm-hmm. continues to exist.
Yeah, if their best alternative to no agreement is like, our this business goes to zero, that's very difficult to negotiate with someone right. in those terms. On the other hand, they stop caring that much. Maybe they don't want to try to squeeze all the blood from the stone because this blood doesn't matter. Got plenty of blood. Boy, that went weird really quick. So yeah, I welcome feedback. We especially would like links if you see particularly mm-hmm. sophisticated analyses for or against or secondary effects. It's the kind of thing where there's so little data available and people don't talk. You know, there's no leakers in the White House. We got no Maggie Haberman of the publishing industry, which, whatever, it is what it is. This piece in Publishers Weekly by John Mayer, that must be a tough name. It's Maher. It's kind of like Kevin Costner. We link to it there. There's a few things. I think it's sort of normal. Like, does Author Guild ever like anything? They don't
That's
ever
a great
like
question.
They don't ever seem to like anything. Which maybe it's been a tough 100-year run for the Authors Guild. I don't know. But the next time the Author Girls see a development happen, like, yeah, this is awesome, it will be the first that I can think of. Where else do you want? Let's do a sponsor. That was segment A. Mm-hmm. Feedback, podcast at bookriot.com. Time for a sponsor.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode.
Well, let's do news, and we can do sort of top-level best books of the year, parachute in for some of these big lists.
Yeah, we have our own look at 2021 for Book Riot also.
Yeah, that's right. Talk about going off a whimper, not a bang. Reed is retiring BEA and BookCon, which is a long time coming, I feel like. And They did all the things they could do, I think, to try to figure out... How to reawaken the corpse of Frankenstein here. But COVID, like it is for so many businesses, unfortunately, was for some business, it's a meteor, right? It's a one-off. And for some business, I think it's an acceleration of trends that were coming. And I think that they're not saying we're going to just not do 2021, but boy, golly, we're going to be back in 2022 tells me that this is not so much idiosyncratic as fast forwarding into the future.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree. Book Expo was in need of major overhauls, if not a complete like burn it down and start over before COVID, as evidenced by several years in which they were like, welcome to the new Book Expo. And right. Like the running joke was like, that's exactly the same as all the other Book Expos you've been to. I think some of this probably is purely logistical also, that, you know, you've got a book, like it's been held at the Javits Center in New York for the last several years. And they had booked it, I think, for 5 years straight. I don't remember which year was going to be the last of the five. But getting out of those kinds of leases for major events requires all kinds of shenanigans and insurance things. And they were probably going to have to decide, like, pretty soon now if they were going to try to hold it in 2022. Yeah.
Right.
And given the, like, extreme shruggy man nature of vaccine distribution timelines, and then beyond that, when people will feel comfortable going back to big crowded events and conventions, I totally get what those meetings must have been like that resulted in the conclusion of like, there's no way that we can plan this for 2022. And if you can't plan for a couple of years out and be in motion, why not also, you know, take a beat and reconfigure when reconfiguring has already been called for. And, you know, this piece in Shelf Awareness notes that ReadPop is engaging in conversations with publishers, booksellers, and other partners, and that those feedback and ideas they get from those people is going to help ReadPop figure out how to best rebuild the events in the future. So I think we'll see some virtual stuff between now and whenever the new thing happens. But there will be a new thing. Will they call it Book Expo 2.0? Who knows?
Yeah, it's really interesting to see. You know, it's funny. I was thinking about this in a different context the other day. Like, inertia works both ways, right? Mm-hmm. Things in motion tend to stay in motion, but also things that aren't in motion tend not to start just moving.
Right.
And so it's less likely now, I feel like, there's a 2024 book con than even with the decelerating speed that was coming out of it, weirdly. Like, we've changed the bit to the default position is not to do it, rather than the wheels are turning. We're always thinking about next year. We have a contract. We have staff that's their job and blah, blah, blah. It's much harder to do 2024's book BEA than it is if you haven't done it for the last 2 years. So I don't know. You and I have almost since the beginning of the show, like, one of our thoroughgoing, like, actual topics rather than bits is, like, what to do with BEA.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as we've said, boy, we should do something else with BEA, I don't think we've ever had the presumptive hubris to say we know what to do, right? I mean, everyone should understand that we're not like they're doing it wrong. It was more like, I don't know what to do, but is it? Yeah. It can't be this.
I think the real struggle there, as I understand it and as I've experienced it, is that it feels nice for everybody in the industry to get together for a couple of days. Like, publicists like meeting the media people, the sales folks inside publishers like a chance to see booksellers and librarians. You know, everybody likes the chance to, like, schmooze. It's author service. Like, it's nice if your author gets featured at one of the lunches, you know, and like, they get to feel special. There's all sorts of, like, feel good stuff that happens, and relationship building kinds of things that happen at Book Expo. But the origin of BEA was originally as the American Booksellers Association conference. It's just the end of 2020 and words are hard. And that was where booksellers would meet with the publishers and they would literally be placing orders for what they were going to sell in their stores. And that's a hard, like, sort of starting place to be anchored to when you then move into a much more fluid kind of buying environment where orders can be placed at any time. You can place your order by email. You could email your rep. You don't even have to have meetings face to face with your sales reps because the internet makes it possible to do that. And over time, I know publishers were like, we're not writing orders at these anymore. Yeah. Like, we're spending all this money on these booths and all these booksellers are coming and librarians are coming, but we're not actually selling any books during this. And if the origin point of it, if the goal was to sell books and write orders and you're not doing that anymore, there has to be a new point. And I think the new point has to pencil out. And it sort of evolved into, like, well, now the point is that we all just get together and it's publicity. And publicity is really hard to make pencil out because it doesn't result in direct trackable sales.
Yeah, so, attribution's hard enough for book sales. Good luck with publicity dollars.
So I continue to have no idea about what a convention that gathers publishers and, like, big players in the industry that makes a meaningful difference to sales should look like. So maybe they just need to start over and be like, what's the thing we're trying to achieve? The thing we're trying to achieve is getting people together for a few days. How do we do that and make it fun? Or, you know, make it productive?
We already have that. I mean, I guess that's the thing. We already have that in terms of, like, we've got all these literary arts and books festivals all over the country. Like, there's demand for events around books like this, or at least there will be when, you know, it's safe to go out and do so. And won't we all enjoy that? But the industry side, you know, I don't really know what makes sense anymore.
Yeah, it feels to me like just the book industry version of what's happened in so many other industries where, like, we have this human sense that, like, going to a meeting in person makes a difference. Mm-hmm. Yet business continues to get done while we're all in our houses working over Zoom.
Yeah.
And would it be better if we were in person? Like, maybe. Would we like it more? Probably. But, like, does the liking it more actually make sense for the bottom line? Or make sense enough to hold a giant event and for publishers to spend tens of thousands of dollars on a booth to be there? Like, that's the real question, is if it's not going to result in writing orders, is it worth it for the knock-on effects and, like, the feelings of having been there, for the sense that you have built a relationship more, even if those same meetings could have happened over Zoom? And I do think that, like, an inside industry event is a different kind of demand than literary arts festivals. Like, publicists want to talk to booksellers. Editors like to meet people who, you know, run other media things and, like, feel like they have a chance to schmooze and get their books covered. And maybe we need that kind of event. Maybe people just think it feels nice. I don't know. I can't imagine what a different version that would be better would look like, but I'm confident we're going to see some attempts at something different.
If networking is the core, which I think is the thing that's hardest to replicate in any other situation, like we're old enough now that some of the first BAs we went to, we would see publishers sitting down with a bookseller and like this giant paper catalog and like go through them, right? And like mark stuff down on a piece of paper about how many copies of whatever they were going to buy. That doesn't need to happen that way anymore. The galley distribution situation, Rebecca, future girl Rebecca Schinke, is very happy about what 2020 has meant for print galleys. Tough beat for print galleys in 2020. But that networking piece of being getting to talk to other people, connect and commingle and, you know, that kind of stuff, I think that is still the hardest thing to do, even over Zoom, right? That incidental... It's different to talk to someone in person. This is all the way is to it. Now, does that need to happen in Javits with these giant booths where people are hauling in these things and getting their galleys and whatever? Like if you stripped it down to like the naked spinning core of BEA, which is just a couple bunch of people in the book industry who want to talk to each other, it feels to me like your overhead could come way down. Like literally the ceilings at Javits are like 16,000 stories tall. Like literally your overhead is way too high at Javits.
Yeah. I once got a sunburn sitting in the press lounge.
Because... It's like a greenhouse in there. Even Louise Glick could grow tomatoes in that place. Oh,
that's a good callback.
Anyway, so that's BEA and BookCon. I have to say, I would be more excited. I like going to BEA, even though now I'm 6 hours away and I've got kids and it's all different things. I always liked being at BEA. We like being there together with our friends and that we work with and people we know. But it was like there was an awful lot of Tootsie Roll Pop to get to the chocolate center of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And maybe just sell the Tootsie Roll if you can. I don't know what that might look like. Okay. Best books of 2020. Question to you.
Mm-hmm.
After looking at some of these, are there consensi? That's clearly the plural of consensus.
Obviously.
Why would you need a plural of consensus? Anyway.
Consensium.
The books of the year emerging from any of these lists.
I am seeing Blacktop Wasteland by S.A. Cosby on a lot of
lists. That's a latecomer, I think. That's charging up. You know, it's breaking late.
Cast by Isabel Wilkerson is on a lot of them.
Yeah, Vanishing Half.
Vanishing Half, Mexican Gothic's on a lot of lists. Your fave for the year, Deacon King Kong.
Oh, which by the way, I don't know when you're going to get this. It's $4.99 on Kindle as a deal today. It may last.
I have it already.
Oh, good. You get. I should have DM'd you. I meant to do that. You know how these things are.
Yeah. I got it in hardcover.
I wasn't talking to you. I was talking about a listener out there who might be listening to this on Monday. Go check Deacon King Kong.
Yeah. So I'm seeing those in a lot of places. Memorial by Brian Washington seems to be coming up a lot. Let's see. Who else? Deacon King Kong's on this other list. Oh, the Iyad Akhtar novel, Homeland Elegies. I'm seeing that pop up.
I think though that in the Blacktop Wastelands are kind of, to use the betting lingo, the Sharps picks are a couple of those guys. The Public's picks are Cast, Vanishing Half, Obama's book, which is just fine. It's good.
It's fine. It's too long.
Are you done?
No.
Yeah,
I'm going to be reading that book forever.
Turns out I know what happens. and doesn't end well.
Oh boy.
Yeah, just interesting to see. The Publisher's Weekly list remains to me one of my favorite lists. That was the first one we talked about. I think a lot of these were getting regression to the mean, meaning kind of consensus picks, which is fine. I like consensus picks. Then you can kind of keep track. But that Publisher's Weekly was first out of the gate, and of the big list that we follow, at least, had a little more personality, I think, than a lot of the other lists.
And you know, even this Amazon top 20 of the year, there's a lot more genre variety. This is a trend that I am so pro on over our careers in books. These best books of the year lists have are no longer like 10 big literary novels and a couple thoughty memoirs and a big nonfiction. Like, it's great to see a suspense book about like a getaway driver be on the top 20 books.
Mexican Gothic, great example.
Right.
Like, horror novel by Latina writer.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, like The Group is that, you know, big memoir about group therapy. The Isabel Wilkerson is probably the most predictable to appear on like a traditional best books of the year list.
Except it would have been written by David McCullough.
Right.
No, I'm serious. Like, that's
you're right. Yeah. The James
cast, not the cast, the author and subject matter. That is new, but like the form and style and like where it fits in.
Yeah. Saigon, nice to see that on here. That's sort of a dark horse of the best of lists. It's cool to see more variety in terms of genre and to see like mainstream big lists like this take genre seriously and recognize, like, there have always been great books in all the genres, but for a really long time it was, you know, just the New York Times talking about like Carl Nausgaard or whatever his name
is. Yeah, right. It's Franz until the end of time.
Right.
Here's a question for you. We need a scoreboard for just the podcast, my app idea, so we could take, you know, keep track of these things. I'm not sure I'd come out ahead, so maybe that's why we're not keeping it. Will the best-selling book of 2021 be a 2021 release?
Oh. You know, that is a great question, Jeff.
Yeah, it is. Thank you very much for validating that question.
I think it will be.
Okay.
Because we haven't had a 2020 release that was a big runaway book club hit.
Yeah, we didn't. I was thinking the same thing. We're ready for one. We've all read Crawdads. They've all read Crawdads.
Everybody's
be that much oxygen left.
Right. And there were some great novels this year that I think in a normal year would have maybe had the legs to be a big commercial book club hit, but 2020 just, you know, not normal. And I think when we get to, I don't know, Q2 of 2021, and there's hopefully like some vaccination momentum and people
going out and we're going to the beach, I'm taking some books.
You're having some things that feel more like normal life or an emergence into at least being out in the world again, and some headspace for being in the world again and less headspace devoted to COVID things and election things. I think then it opens up room for there to be another big hit like that. And it's and whether it's fiction or a big memoir like Educated was, like, to be the best-selling book of the year, you basically need to be a runaway book club hit.
You need to break out of book nerd sphere or never have been a part of it in the case of Crawdads. And then catch fire. You need people to talk to other people about, boy, you need to read this. Boy, wasn't this great and fun and interesting. Or I couldn't put it down in the case of Gone Girl. Or I felt so big in the case of Educated or When Breath Becomes Air, right? Like, these things are hard to predict, but obvious in hindsight. Or not surprising, typically, in hindsight. Like, it looks... Crawdads. I'm still starting to decide how... I mean, look, it's an outlier, so of course you're surprised. But is it that different than some other books that take fire? Like, it is, but it has some of the same things that, say, Girl on the Train or something like that had baked into it. I was looking... I guess we haven't put on our schedule yet, our 2021 spring preview, but I've got a long list of 37 titles.
Already? Woo.
Yes. Had some fun with the catalogs. Also, it turns out catalogs are great online. And again, it's the one that you don't know that surprises you, right? Because by definition, you can't know it. Sometimes you have some suspicions. Like, I remember the Year of the Nest. Remember that with Cynthia?
Oh,
what's her name?
Uh-huh.
And that wasn't Crawdads, but that moved.
That had a huge publicity budget, too.
And that one this year, I think, was a book we don't love to talk about, but American Dirt had a huge publicity thing, and it moved, though that's waning. Mm-hmm. I don't have a great... If I had a few chips to put down on the roulette wheel here, I think I'm taking them back to the cashier and getting myself a steak dinner, I guess what I'm saying. I don't have a great... I have things I'm super excited, like really as excited for a slate of books I've been a long time, and I don't know why. Maybe it's because of 2021. I feel like it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. Like Patricia Lockwood's novel is coming out in February.
Oh,
like,
God. I mean, weird and fun is that?
Is that just going to be? I mean, the Ishiguro is coming out, and I don't want to step on the... But I'm not picking any of those to be like, you know, the thing that people are reading about that I see like my friends from high school reading on their Facebook feeds.
Right.
I just don't have it. So anyway, but I feel like there's a big hit shaped thing out there. And mm-hmm. I agree with you completely. I'm glad you said that, because I was going to say not quite articulated like that. Of course, the other situation is that it's Crawdads and A Promised Land. Because I think Crawdads might still be the best-selling fiction title of the year for adult fiction. Now we're really into rarefied air. Anyway, I don't know. Like, go take out the list. I'm not sure. We didn't put the Goodreads Choice Awards in on here. That is so fragmented now. I'm not even sure to make of it. It is a popularity contest. I think you will be surprised that there are almost no surprises. I guess this Matt Haig book, The Midnight Library, I've seen a bunch of people read about. I know nothing about it, and I remain completely uninterested in it. I don't know why. Just not. But that one won for fiction. But they break things into historical fiction. Like, it's not a true test. I don't think
it's a truth test. Universally acknowledged, though, that if you write a book that has a library or a bookstore in the title, and then you are in the Goodreads competition, you're going to at least go pretty far.
I would like to back test that data. I think there's way more of those that do nothing. I think there's a lot of them is what it is. I think there's a lot of them. And so
I know. I just think if you make it into the competition.
If you manage to make the first cut. Right.
Yeah. Then it's like, it's a book about libraries. Mm-hmm. We have to vote for it. Like, I mean, that's just... Yeah. I have a whole side rant in me about books and how they are... an easy ploy, but we can save that for another day.
You mean panderings used in rare books? We should write a book called Panderings Used in Rare Books. I have a side rant. Sorry. 2 minutes. So I was watching The West Wing the other night because you and Amanda got me started. And Michelle and I were blowing through the Christmas episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's in the first season that Jed Bartlett goes to a rare bookstore to buy gifts, which is like twiest hipstery professor or president thing to do.
Yep.
Fine, whatever, do the thing. The name of the bookstore is Rare Books. Sorkin, my guy. What is that? You couldn't Google?
Proper you couldn't names, name it a serrated proper crescendo?
Names, proper names used in rare books. You could name it whatever. There's no rare bookstore in the hit. We can go back to Prospero in The Tempest. Wherever Prospero was getting his wares was not called Rare Books. I don't understand that. It really made me mad.
I wonder if it was like they filmed at some location that was called, like O'Neill's Rare Books, but they had to just like not put the O'Neill.
Yeah, I get that.
Sign.
Call them McGilligan's. I don't. Such a weird thing to care about, but also a weird thing to do.
For as detail obsessed as Sorkin could be about other things, it is funny.
It's called Rare Books.
I'll have to go back and find it on Billions, because there's a whole subplot on Billions where like the bad guy gets access to the guy who thinks he's a good guy's collection of Winston Churchill, like rare Winston Churchills, and then he knows that this guy's gonna try to buy all the remaining ones, so he buys them up from mm-hmm. all over the place. And it's a classic like guy walks into an old bookstore, and then there's like a 75-year-old man in baggy khaki pants and a cardigan sweater telling him how much he can get his Churchills for. Also called Rare Books.
There's this weird non-book person like mental model of used bookstore people.
Right, like, can you be a rare bookseller in a film if you're not an old man who, like, shuffles out from a stock room covered in dust?
Yeah, like, if you don't wear corduroy, like, they can't see you in a rare books room.
Right.
It's like camouflage if you're wearing anything but corduroy. You could walk in there wearing a black turtleneck and a beret, but they wouldn't see you if you don't have elbow patches and, like, you need to shave and there's still some food on your shirt.
You have to let your eyes relax like those magic eye things. Yes, and then the old man emerges out of the shelves. The corduroy really just blends in with all the deckled edges.
It's basically many little spines.
Corduroy pants that are printed with book spines.
Do people wear corduroy anymore? I had a real corduroy phase. I know you're going to be surprised while I was a grad student. In the shock of all shocks.
I do think people wear corduroy.
Wide whale, they're all narrow whale.
People wear pants anymore is the real
question.
Couldn't
tell you. Outside of my expertise at this moment. I'm telling
you. It is the end of the year.
It really is. It really is. Let's do one last sponsor because I'm sure they'll appreciate that placement that we just gave them right there.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Charming, easygoing, and rich, Xavier Castillo has the world at his fingertips. He also has no interest in taking over his family's empire, but that hasn't stopped women from throwing themselves at him. Unless, of course, the woman in question is his publicist. The cool, the intelligent, the ambitious Sloan Kensington, who is a high-powered publicist who's used to dealing with difficult clients, but none infuriate or tempt her more than a certain billionaire heir with his stupid dimples and laid-back attitude. She may be forced to work with him, but she'll never fall for him because he's a client and that's all he'll ever be, right? Right, girl, like we all know. So just in case you didn't know, author Anna Wong is the best-selling author and book talk viral author of the Twisted Love series, the King of Sin series. Miss Wong got it going on, okay? Make sure to check out King of Sloth by Anna Wong. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, kind of grab bag, other news items. Mm-hmm. Where do you want to go?
Well, I want to make sure we talk about Book Riot's Read Harder Challenge for 2021 for the seventh year running.
Something like that.
Yeah, it is the seventh year running. We're doing the Read Harder Challenge, which is, if you're new around here, welcome. 24 tasks, so an average of 2 per month over the course of the year that are designed to help you expand your reading horizons. Really great list. And it's fun. The longer we do this, the harder it is to think of these tasks.
Yeah, the task itself is the hardest thing to do.
Because we've done the general, like, read a science fiction book, read a romance book. So they get more specific, which I also think makes it more interesting. But it kicks off with read a book you've been intimidated to read. Read a nonfiction book about anti-racism. Read a non-European novel in translation. There's a whole bunch. Read an LGBTQ plus history book. Read a novel that's in genre by an Indigenous First Nations or Native American author. Read a fanfic. Read a fat positive romance. Read a romance by a trans or non-binary author. Read a middle grade mystery. So, like, as you can see, this is going to take you all over the map in terms of category, genre, intended audience, subject matter. And that is the point. Expose yourself to a bunch of different authors and genres and stories that maybe you would have sought out on your own over time, or that maybe you wouldn't have bumped into if you weren't trying to, you know, fill every square on your bingo card. And there are posts that are published over the last 2 weeks of the year. So, you know, by the time you're ready to, like, really start for 2021, you'll have them that give reading recommendations for every one of these categories. And then there's also a Read Harder group on Goodreads that if you're a Goodreads person, you can participate in and share recommendations as well. A really awesome list that our editorial team put together this year with assists from our contributors. It's always really fun on Read Harder, like brainstorming day in the Slack, just to see what people come up with and how the tasks sort of morph as everybody gets in there together to help shape them. So you can find it by going to bookriot.com/readharder, or we'll have have a link specifically to the challenge list in the show notes, but a really great list going into 2021. And as a bonus, if you complete the Read Harder Challenge and you send in your completed form, because there's a PDF that you can complete at the end of next year, you can get 30% off of a purchase at Out of Print Clothing. Mm. So, yeah.
Very cool.
A little extra reward.
If you could assign the Bookish Internet one reading task for the year, Rebecca, it doesn't have to be a read harder one. It could be a read easier, but you get to direct it. And you can do this for laughs or for something as prosaic as aggregate good. What would you pick?
I think I would do something along the lines of like read a book that you're interested in if no one else ever knows that you've read it, you know, like where it's not going to be about putting it on your Instagram. It's not going to be, there's no external proof or validation that you have read this book.
I like and that.
Thank you. I don't think it comes nicely into like a quick phrase that we could package onto a Read Harder Challenge.
Well, you could do it another way. But something you want to read, but you don't want to tell anybody else about it. Or you could do it that way.
You could do it that way. I think that's a different kind of pick, maybe. Like,
really?
This, yeah, because like you want to read, but you don't want to tell anybody else about it. It's like you want to keep it secret. This is like you read a book that you're going to read even if you don't get credit for it from the world. You know, like there's so much of our reading lives, so much of our lives in general is like on the internet or performative in some way, or like that Portlandia sketch that just devolves into the them going, did you read? Did you read? Did you read? Did you did you read? So like if no one was going to know, what would you read? Like what are you just interested in? That
I am
is
the
not
wrong recipient for that, because I'm like, what are people doing if not that?
No, I agree. Like that's the older, and I think this is a product of us like aging as well. Like the older that you get, the less you care about.
Just read
I think,
book about tall ships. Who cares?
Right. Yeah. Who else reads books about submarines, Jeff? Like, you know, that there's a lot of like, I think people feel a lot of pressure of like, I should read, I want to read romances, but I should read serious nonfiction or whatever. And I think as like in all years, but especially after the year that we've had, like read the thing that you are drawn to and just assume like that no one is paying attention. Maybe that's the prompt, is like, what are you reading if really no one is paying attention to the books you post on your Instagram?
That's way too healthy. I'm not doing that. That's not my, I want to do.
You're totally doing that.
No, I do that. That's not my pick for what I want other people to read, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm doing something else. I want people to read A History of X and N Things. In a subject you're interested in, we talked a week or two ago about how there's a whole category, and it's actually most books that we don't get assigned in school. So you don't know. I think a lot of people that weren't drawn to books that they were offered in whatever situation don't ever realize that like there's a whole world that's meant out there just to kind of be interesting. Right? You don't have to learn anything. It's not necessarily good for you. It's just sort of interesting. I think we're talking about Trevor Noah, Born a Crime, the recommendation. So it's like, I wish people got that earlier. And so I think there's categories of books that people think, well, it's not Donna Tartt or it's not a classic. It's not poetry. It's not personal development. It's also not awesome for Instagram or for my book club. But like, one of the amazing things about books that still remains amazing is how many different kinds there are about every kind of subject. No other genre can do, no other medium can do. The video can't do it. Even podcasts can't do it. Where it's just someone with a word processor and a crazy dream can write A History of the Pencil and 75 Anecdotes, which is a real book that I DM'd you this week.
Yeah, I can confirm it is real.
But there's like that for anything you care about. And the access to history you get, and also just the snackability of it. And there's low stakes, but you've really learned something.
Ooh, snackability.
I wish people had more of a reading experience like that, that their expectation wasn't so loaded. And they didn't, it wasn't all like, I want to read just for plot, which is fine. That's a fine way of doing it, but you always want that. And that you can scratch a little bit of the reading should be good for me. I want reading to do something for me that movies can't. And I think this is that.
I totally love this as well. I think this is a great one because it's like, it's a reparative reading experience with nonfiction.
Reparative reading experience. That's what I like to hear.
Mm-hmm. And people have a lot of like book stuff around nonfiction, especially around the notion that it's all dry and boring, or that like it's the, I don't know, the bran of your reading diet.
Yeah, right, totally.
And and that it's not fun. And there are so many fun ways to do nonfiction, and there are great authors doing them. And you're absolutely right that you can find a nonfiction book that is interesting and fun about basically whatever you're interested in, even if what you're interested in is the history of pencils, which there's at least one reader for that book, and he's on this podcast.
It's right now. They moved one unit.
I think that's a great task too. So many people have stuff.
Books are exciting.
Yeah, I think maybe find a fun, accessible entry point to poetry is another one that I would give people, because it's so like poetry does a thing like what music does that sort of bypasses your analytical mind, and you have to feel
the matrix plug goes right in somehow.
You have to feel the thing first, and I definitely needed reparative poetry experiences after school, you know, after especially after like the high school anthology of great American poems that's like, what's going on with the wheelbarrow, you know.
So much depends on that.
A lot of it took me like a couple decades to recover from it. I would like to have
talk about an impenetrable wall. You walk into a bookstore, you know, back in the late 70s when you could do that, and you go to the poetry section. Have fun as a civilian. It is tough. That's a tough one.
It is tough just browsing a poetry section for yourself. Like,
oh, look, I think, another poem.
Or maybe,
I don't understand.
Maybe this is the bigger read harder challenge, like the bigger task that sort of connects the two things we're talking about is like, prescribe yourself a reparative reading experience. Like, figure out like some, I don't, trauma is way too strong of a word, but like, what's a reading, like, what kind of reading baggage do you have?
Oh, I see. I gotcha. Yeah. And you know, like, there's this one day with Dickens and Tale in Two Cities, and I had to read it out loud in class and play Charles Darnay when I was 15. That may be specific. I don't know. I'm throwing it out there.
Uh-huh.
Just a general.
You need to read Tale of Two Cities and have a good experience.
My soul just broke out in hives when you said that. I like that one too. With poetry, you know, the interesting about poetry, it's so underread that you could even set up a heuristic like, okay, go pull up the National Book Award for Poetry, right? Or the Pulitzer Prize, and go to random.org and press in, you know, 1 to 40 and just read the Pulitzer Prize winning poetry collection from whatever number you get. I bet you'll have an interesting experience because their poetry is great. But the speaking of the intellectual aesthetic inertia to get into a poetry space, because most poetry, again, it's about something, and it doesn't do the work that prose can do for it to help you out. Like that's it goes right into your brainstem, but also goes right into your brainstem. You know, is the anti-pattern there? Oh, let's call that a show. We can keep some of this other stuff. Is there anything else we need to say now about these other sundry things? In a normal week, we'd have other things to talk about, but we had AAA news and then diversions of our own device.
I just want to note that we did get news earlier this week that Bob Woodward is going to write with, Robert Costa, both of the Washington Post. They are going to write the book on the final days of the Trump presidency and the first phase of the Biden presidency. And that's all we know. We don't know like how long that first phase of the Biden presidency will be that they're writing about. We don't know what a predicted title or publication date is. But I can't remember if I said it to you or if I said it on the podcast. This is the book that I want. Like the Woodward inside look at what
Haberman. I think I'm going
Haberman. I want both. Like I refuse to chew. When this broke, Amanda texted me at like 7:30 in the morning. It was like, Bob Woodward's going to write the last days of Trump book. And I think my reply was almost exactly like, oh, between this and Maggie Haberman, like I'm getting everything I want. There'll be different takes and that will be fascinating. And we do know that like Donald Trump likes to just call Bob Woodward on the phone and talk to him. And Woodward has gotten really interesting.
He's going to have nothing better to do here in about 30 days.
Yeah. Like, have they been having conversations since November 3rd? Because I really want to know about that. So
hasn't been governing, I'll tell you that much.
Right. So I will be waiting with relatively bated breath for what this Bob Woodward book is going to
be. It's
going to
be a while probably, but Woodward can, I'm sure there's going to be a whole Woodward industrial complex to get this book moving in the right direction. All right. What are people waiting for? I guess we have another. Oh, so our next show is going to be Monday, December 21st.
Yes.
The 28th. And then we said we were going to do our favorite books of the year, which we will do, which is coming a little bit later.
Yeah, I think we're off on the 28th.
Basically. Are we off on the 28th?
Yeah, we have a show on the 21st and a show on January 4th.
Okay, so we're off on the 28th. So one of these shows will be our favorite non-book things of, of 2020, and one of them will be our favorite reads of 2020, meaning these are books that didn't necessarily come out in 2020. We just happen to have read them there. A lot of nice feedback about recommendations so far, though no one has actually read the book, but a lot of purchasing happening. Go forth and gift, even it is to unto thyself. Rebecca, we'll talk to you later.
Have a good one.